Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Well, the emerging market crisis of early 2014 is raging along, and several countries are becoming increasingly chaotic and desperate. So one of those is Argentina. And of course, Argentinians are experiencing this sort of thing, having just gone through it all back in 2001. So I'm wondering how things are unfolding and what sorts of lessons learned are being applied by those living there. Today, we are fortunate to be speaking with Fernando Aguirre, also known as Furfol, author of Surviving the Economic Collapse. The book, Furfol Experienced the Hyperinflationary Destruction of Argentina's Economy Personally in 2001, and has since dedicated his professional career to educating the public about his experiences and observations of its lingering aftermath. And of course, it looks like we're having a renewed version of it today. His blog, Surviving in Argentina, found at furfol.blogspot.com, is covering the events as they unfold, as well as other more general topics around the idea of navigating an economic dislocation wherever you happen to live. Given rising concerns about the possibility of an unfortunate conclusion to central bank meddling, our listeners are increasingly asking to hear from voices that have firsthand experience with what it's like to live through a large, shall we say, adjustment process. Furfol, so glad you could join us.
Chris, it's great to be talking with you again.
Okay, bring us up to date. What's happening in Argentina right now with respect to its currency, the peso?
Well, actually, pretty recently, January 22, the peso lost 15% of its value. It devalued quite a bit. It ended up losing 20% of its value that week. And it's been pretty crazy since then. There's inflation has been rampant in some sectors, going up to 100% in food, grocery stores, 20, 30% in some cases. So it's been pretty complicated. Lots of stores that don't want to be selling stuff until they get updated prices. Suppliers holding on and waiting to see how things go, which is something that we're familiar with because that happened back in 2001 when everything went down as we know it did.
So 100% or 20% inflation, are those yearly numbers?
No, these are numbers as in a matter of days. This is in just one day. For example, cement in Bariloche, one of the towns in southern Argentina, went up 100% overnight.
Wow.
Doubling in price. Grocery stores in Córdoba, even in Buenos Aires, people are talking about increase of prices of 20-30% just these days. I actually have family in Argentina that they're telling me that they go to a hardware store and they're not even able to buy stuff from there because stores want to hold on and see how prices unfold in these following days.
Right. So this is one of the great mysteries of inflation. It's obviously flying money, right? So everybody's trying to get rid of their money. So you think that would actually increase commerce. But if you are on the other end of that transaction, if you happen to be the business owner, you have every incentive to withhold items for as long as possible. So one of the great ironies, I guess, is that even though money is flying around like crazy, goods start to disappear from the shelves. Is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. Shelves halfway empty. The government always trying to muscle its way through these kind of problems, just trying to force companies to stock back products and such, but they just keep holding on. For example, gas has gone up 12% these last few days. And there's really nothing they can do about it, but because if they don't increase the prices, companies just are not willing to sell. So it's a pretty tricky situation to be in.
Is there any sort of price controls going on right now? Has anything been mandated?
Well, as you know, price controls don't really work.
They've
tried this before in Argentina. Actually, last year, one of the big news was that the government was freezing prices on food and certain appliances. It didn't work. Just a few days later, those supposedly frozen prices were going up, and as soon as they officially released them, they would just double in price.
So let me ask you this then. How many people in Argentina actually still have money in Argentine banks in dollars? Because I guess one of the features of 2001 was people had money in dollars in the banks. There was a banking holiday. A couple weeks later, banks open up. Surprise, you have the same number in your account, only it's pesos, not dollars. And it was an effective theft, if I could use that term. So,
exactly.
So is anybody keeping money in the banks at this point, or how's that working?
Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify for people listening, those banks that did that are the same banks that are found all over the world. They're not like strange South American Argentine banks.
Okay.
They're
yep.
the same banks. So if they're willing to steal from people in one place, don't be surprised if they're willing to do it in another place as well.
No surprise here.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be surprised if it happens to you as well. To answer your question, if people really don't trust banks much, and especially since there was a ban, an official ban of some sort for average people to buy foreign currency, so they just go to the black market, and the average Argentine person has his money under the couch. You know, they buy dollars in the black market at a much higher price. The peso, it's officially 8 pesos per dollar. Unofficially, it's almost 13 pesos per dollar. So there's quite a bit of a difference there. Still, people choose to get away of the official currency.
Now, I understand the Argentine government has limited the number of dollars you can officially purchase to, what, 2,000 a month, something like that?
Well, it's not even that. 80% of Argentines are not simply not allowed to buy dollars.
Yeah.
You have to present your income, and then the local authorities decide if based on your salary you're allowed to buy. It's generally going to be $50, $100, $200 a month, if that. Many cases, even doctors, people with very good wages, they're not even allowed to buy dollars whatsoever.
But that would be at the official exchange rate of around 8.
Exactly. What most people do then is go to what they call cuevas, like caves, which is, you know, places where the black market, you buy dollars at a much higher price, of course.
Now, what happens if you want to just say duck over the bay, go to Uruguay? Can you buy dollars there?
Well, that's something that has been happening quite a bit. People have been going over to Uruguay and taking advantage of that. Of course, Uruguay had to implement some of their own restrictions, and they weren't very happy with people going over there. What they started doing is Argentina started placing checkpoints in some of the well-known spots where the port where you get a boat to cross over to Uruguay. So they started controlling who was traveling, what they were doing, pretty much a blanket invasion of privacy.
Not surprised. So let's imagine that people in Argentina have managed to squirrel away as much as they can in the mattress in the form of harder currencies, but still all of this is unfolding. And we talked about some of the economic impacts that there's things disappearing from shelves. What else is happening economically, and how are people coping?
Well, imagine you have your wages, your salaries are still in pesos, and people, this basically melts your purchasing power right in front of you. So people are trying to stock up on certain food products. They know that what they buy today, it's going to be costing maybe 2-3 times as much just a few weeks, even a few months from now. So they're dealing with the problem of empty shelves, as we said before. There's also limits to how much you can buy. Sugar, vegetable oil, there's limits, and it's usually going to be 1 or 2 units per family.
With the idea being that obviously you'd want to purchase early and often when you're in inflationary times, right?
Exactly. Absolutely.
Well, so the store shelves are bare. What's the impact on jobs going to be going down the road?
There's no way of being certain of anything in Argentina, especially with this scenario. You're looking at, people are not, there's people that honestly do go hungry, but for the average guy that does have a job right now, he's going to be getting by. Maybe he's going to be having to eat something else. Maybe he's going to be having to eat more rice than meat and such. At the same time, it's having lived in Argentina for so long, it's you get used to living week by week, month by month. That's mm-hmm. as far as you can plan. There's already no credit. There's already no credit with your credit card, so as to make 12-month payments or 6-month payments. So things get just a little bit tougher.
Now, the government of Argentina at this point in time, are they committing the same mistakes that led to the 2001 crisis? You know, there was this recovery period, a little debt default. Everything seemed to be going well again. Of course, as we now know, much of that was due to the fact that the whole world was being reflated with dollars everywhere, right, and yen and euros and other things. So the developed world was flooding the world with dollars. The so-called undeveloped parts of the world were benefiting from all of that. Now that the tide has turned, governmentally, are you seeing were the same mistakes made, which was, wow, times are good, let's just pretend like everything's right and good, or had real structural reforms been made?
No, that's one of the things that worries people the most. There's really no plan for anything. Mm. The idea is just to deny what's happening. And it's like going to the doctor, you're sick, and you're not telling him what's happening to you. There's no way of solving that. Especially, this is a government that has always had a communist, very left-leaning idea, even though at the same time, these are people that have gotten themselves incredibly wealthy beyond our imagination, thanks to their policies, right?
Yep.
And there's no plan whatsoever. The idea is, right now, for example, the president has seized all sorts of communication. She's just not making public appearances of any kind. The Minister of Economy, he has these Kenyan ideas of economy that really don't work. More restrictions, more freezing of prices that just doesn't get the job done.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that actual survival skills that some people think of, you know, boiling water and bamboo contraptions or whatnot, that those are relatively low on the coping totem pole, and that things like fitness, physical fitness, haggling, extreme budgeting, those are more important early on. How does that advice map into what's happening in Argentina right now?
Well, it's something that people are, I think they never got rid of those skills. Mm-hmm. They've needed them to survive ever since. And in times like these, it's especially important. Know how to handle your own personal finances, and know how to budget, buy as cheap as you can, have a good grasp on your home economy. Also finding ways of creating more income, maybe starting your own side business. Anyone can have a profession, even a hobby that can be capitalized in some way. That's something that we did in Argentina in 2001. That's something that people are, of course, doing right now as well.
Now, how about alternative economies? I mean, if your currency system breaks down, you find other ways of conducting transaction, barter being the lowest form of that. But what sorts of things are arising or would you expect to arise as the currency system falls apart?
Well, the barter economy it's something that we did experience in 2001 when the economy fully collapsed and banks had just closed and there was really just no way of getting by. At the same time, you had huge amounts of unemployment, so people just traded whatever it is that they had or skill they had for what they needed. Eventually, we realized that you still need some form of currency. I think that there's not going to be a huge increase in barter economy, not even very significant, but we're going to be seeing quite a bit of loss of standards of living as people just focus more on surviving than anything else. These measures taken by the government, the inflation especially targeting those that still have something to be taken away from them, which is what's left of the Argentine middle class. So it's going to be more people becoming poor as time goes by.
And that dynamic, it obviously could create some social tensions if it turns out that certain individuals are fantastically wealthy by the same process. So it's really a point I want to sort of dig at here. You know, we saw this in Weimar Germany, 1923 to 1928. It's talked about as this extraordinary wealth destruction that devastated the middle class. But if you twist it slightly, it wasn't a destruction, it was a transfer. Like the land didn't go away, the houses didn't go away, the productive assets are still there, maybe underutilized, but fundamentally, who owned them shifted enormously. And so I understand there's this very popular way for historians, who knows who's funding them, to look back through time and say, oh, it was wealth destruction, like it's some, like a meteor hit.
Right.
Oh, it just went away. But it doesn't go away, right? It actually goes from point A to point B. Is there a sense that people understand that process and that could create tension?
I don't think that most people understand what you're saying in terms of wealth not disappearing. As you say, there's still the buildings, there's still the infrastructure, there's still the work, the labor that people do. If you Right. work your behind off all day long, there's something there. Now, the problem is that your effort is not being you're not being compensated for that. But that wealth you're creating is going somewhere. And usually, as you say, it's focused on a very small number of people that are taking advantage of that. A good example of that would be in Argentina. The only thing really worth something on a large scale was the production of soy, agriculture. The government slashed that with 80% tax, you know, leaving basically nothing to the producers. And that, well, you know, they got away with that for quite a bit of time. Now that the price of that particular commodity is going down, they really have nowhere else to take money from.
Well, that is the process. It happens over and over and over again. And so it's in this new internet age, and with social media and whatnot, I think it's possible for people to come across information that would explain what's happening more readily than in times past. But it's kind of the oldest game in the book, isn't it, right? Certain people and institutions create a whole lot of claims against an underlying economy. Eventually, there's too many claims. And instead of the people who made the claims, too many of those claims, having to eat the losses for having taken, made some very bad loans and other decisions, it inevitably falls on having the wealth be transferred and extracted from the remaining productive portions of the society. That can only go on so long until, if I use this metaphor, until the parasite takes too much blood from the host. Yes. And then there's some other sort of an adjustment process. Do you see that in the future?
I don't see it in the future. I see it in the past. It happened in December last year, just a couple, less than 2 months ago. There was widespread rioting across the entire country. In Argentina, the police department in one province went on strike because that governor was not aligned with the president. They punished him by not helping him out. Now, as other police forces saw that the strike went on, they started going on strike themselves. The entire country's police force went on strike, ended up in rioting over a week of anarchy across the entire country, with at least 13 dead. And widespread looting, thousands of stores looted across the country. That's the kind of scenario we're looking at.
And obviously, that's a very turbulent period to be in. What were most people doing during that? I assume the rioters were a subset. Was everybody else just sort of holed up in their house?
People were holding on in their houses. Some neighbors were organizing so as to defend their communities. Many looters got killed. There's stories we still haven't heard of. A lot of that just we may never hear of. So I know for a fact that, I mean, there's plenty of footage on that on YouTube, thousands of hours of video on that. It was really widespread, and people just fended it on for themselves because there was no government controlling anything for at least a week.
And who was out doing the looting? Is this, you know, your typical 18 to 25-year-old male cohort, or was this more widespread?
It's interesting because it's, of course, some of the people you already have a good idea that may end up doing that. You know, some of the known elements that we always see when there's rioting and looting taking advantage of that. But then there were people with fancy 4x4 trucks just parking it in a in a large store and loading it up with appliances, washing machines, TVs. There was quite a bit of madness during those times.
Interesting. So, and this was widespread. This wasn't just in one metropolitan
area.
No,
this was really widespread. Buenos Aires, Córdoba, mostly, especially in the provinces across the country, it was pretty bad. Yes.
And that settled out a little bit for now. But how do you see this playing out? Is throughout the rest of this year, say?
Well, at least they're talking. Economists are talking about at least 30% inflation. Some of the ones that are more positive say it's not going to be getting worse than 40%. That may be true for some people. For the middle class, it's going to be worse than that for sure. And I think that if things get desperate enough, if people start getting hungry in a large scale, it is. I don't think they're going to be seeing the end of this year. They're going to be having the government, the president's going to be having to resign or call for early elections or some other measure.
Well, I heard that Argentina is limiting, or if not banning, imports at this point in time to prevent the hemorrhaging of what remaining foreign currency reserves, that is, dollars that they have. There's a burn rate on those reserves right now, and when they go to zero, you're in big trouble, especially if you have any debt that's denominated in that currency. So given that, it's going to be very difficult for people in Argentina to get their hands on imported goods. So, you know, good luck if you have a repair that requires a part coming from
exactly.
somewhere, things like that. And what is Argentina's main exports? Like, where is it getting its hard currency from?
Well, soy production was called like the green oil, the green gold.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the phrases used, that was the main thing they were exporting, and they still do, but I mean, they've already taxed that so much, and the price is not going up anymore, so, and they already looted the personal savings of people, the retirement funds, they nationalized those,
mm-hmm.
so there's, you know, there's really no one else to take away money from. Imports, as you were saying, this isn't anything new. It's been going on for at least a year that imports are basically stopped. And even for the average person buying stuff online, it's not going through customs anymore. It's getting stopped. You're only allowed to buy two items, and it hasn't got to be more than $25. I mean, it's a pretty bad scenario to be in.
So what I'm wondering then is around the advice that you would give, like knowing that you could see these things coming. My personal advice is you want to prepare early and often, but that's when things are still working well. I think that when you're in the throes of the crisis, like Argentina is right now, that moment of trying to go out and stockpile and accumulate, I actually think that's not a responsible thing to do, because at that point, everybody is, you know, you can't have everybody trying to hoard at the same time, because then that's really unfair and a lot of people get left out. So I think there's a strong case to be made for preparing early and often. But once you're in the middle of it, that's no time to try and figure out how you're gonna take care of these things. How many people do you think had done the prepare early and often model? How many Argentinians had saw
well,
this coming?
Well, I think that everyone saw this coming, especially if, I mean, there's really no way to expect anything else with the measures they were taking. But Argentines are pretty much used to this sort of thing. So
mm-hmm.
they just roll with it. They just, when they don't have, they just do without. They have a family helping each other. It is, you know, it's the way a lot of people have been living for most of their adult life, if you think about it that way. I think that, as you say, it's a good idea to be prepared in advance for this sort of thing. The supplies that we all know you should have, food, water, of course, at home in case there's problems. But when something like this happens in a country, when it's so, you know, so bad, there's really not, it's not a short or medium term period of to go by. I think that the best thing is what I did myself is just get out of there as soon as you can.
Well, so let's talk about that. How many people do you think in Argentina have left, and who do they tend to be?
Oh, well, this really started back in 2001. At least 300,000 ended up in Spain. So some numbers vary, but easily over a million people have left the country in all these years. And the thing is that those that could leave, most of them ended up leaving closer to the first, well, not the first, but the big economic collapse in 2001. Last year, a lot of people were also leaving. They usually end up in Spain, in Italy, those that have European citizenship. And it's generally going to be younger people, especially because many countries are more welcoming of younger workers than older ones.
Well, unfortunately for the people who went to Spain, they jumped out of the fire and right back into a frying pan.
Yes, exactly.
So they've got to be feeling blighted at this point, particularly with youth unemployment there at 50% or greater. So I want to ask about that then, because here's the question. What's really different in your mind then between Argentina and the so-called developed nations, maybe Europe? Like structurally, what's really different? What's the same?
The difference is, yes, they are significant. As you were saying, people left Argentina, ended up in Spain, and they saw this huge crisis ongoing still. But at the same time, it's not a developing nation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a third world country. So there's quite a bit of differences. You can expect certain things from the political system in Spain. You cannot expect basically anything from the Argentine politicians. They just, I mean, they themselves steal companies like they did with Repsol and BP. You know, the petrol company, the Spanish petrol company.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's really no legal frame to go by. At the same time, in Spain, you at least know that the legal system works. There's a certain safety nets that people can somewhat count on. There's really none of that in Argentina. It's pretty much everyone taking care of themselves, and the government just not being there whatsoever. I know of a lot of people that ended up in Spain, and in spite of the country, they know for a fact that it's just much better off than living in Argentina. One of the big things is, of course, crime, which is out of control in Argentina, especially because the policy is just to, same with the economy, just deny it, so it keeps getting worse. Spain, you at least know that you're somewhat safe on the street.
Well, that's a huge difference, of course, particularly when we're talking about quality of life. As you look wider across the globe, you know, it's always good if there is a border to duck across. You know, from my analysis, the world's been, particularly the developed nations, have been on a credit binge that's at least 4 decades in the making. And maybe it'll go another decade or two. I don't know. Maybe it goes another 2 weeks. I don't know. But structurally, I see that there are too many claims against too few actual resources, and the same dynamic of somehow the already well-connected are vacuuming up ever larger amounts. And to me, that's just a feature of a debt-based money system. This is kind of how they operate. Obviously, in Argentina, where you throw in corruption on top of that, it just exacerbates the problem. But if you were going to be giving advice to people who are living in countries that seem stable, seem reasonable, they're in Spain, they're in Ireland, they're in France,
right.
They're in America, they're somewhere. Do you think that there's a parallel here that they should be aware of in terms of how Argentina is operating, or is it just too fundamentally different how Argentina is going to unfold versus anybody else?
I think that Argentina is a good example of a worst case scenario when things, you know, I don't see the dollar losing 20% of its value overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the dollar is not the peso, as bad as it may be. It's still not the Argentine peso.
Right.
I think that Argentina is a good case study so as to see how things get really bad. And even if they don't get nearly as bad as they did in Argentina, many developed nations, as you were saying, U.S., places in Europe and such, they are seeing a little bit more of it. So it is just a little taste of what Argentina is like, and life is going to be changing towards that direction a little bit. It's not going to be getting that bad. I don't think it's going to be getting you know, completely destroyed as it happened with the Argentine economy, but people are going to be seeing more inequality. There's going to be more poor people. There's going to be more competition for each job, and you will have to be a little bit more creative so as to sustain your quality of life. And there's going to be a lot of people that will just have to adapt to living in a little bit of lower standards of living that they may have been used to themselves, not long ago.
So we mentioned some of those coping things, for physical fitness, haggling, extreme budgeting. What else is on your list of important skills to have?
I think that's it's a good point to insist on how important it is to be marketable in a job market that's it's going to be more and more competitive as time goes by. Anything that you can add towards that, any additional trait or bonus that you can offer your employer, or being good at creating your own income, starting your own business, even if it's a small scale, doesn't matter. At least you have something to work with. Being good at managing your finances, trying to stay healthy and fit, because all these things, people think that you know you're going to be physical fit for some outrageous survival scenario. It's mostly a matter of being well prepare for being more stressed, dealing with more tension that you may be used to.
Right, and of course, being physically fit is essential to that. And here's one of the main things that that we're really about at Peak Prosperity is this idea that the goal of life is to be happy and fulfilled, and it's still possible, we believe, to have a much, much lower standard of living and a higher quality of life, to still really enjoy life and live it fully, even though you have less material stuff. And yes. And this is, you know, one of the main points we try to make is that if you're coasting along and all of a sudden your stuff is taken away from you, that's a really traumatic event, very stressful. It hurts like crazy. But if you yourself made that same adjustment to the same lower amount of stuff, it can be completely joyous, fine, a completely reasonable process. It's really a difference of doing it on your own terms rather than having it enforced on you by some other terms. That seems to us like to be a, I don't care what country you live in, that seems like a reasonable way to live.
I think it's a great point. I think especially Americans are maybe a little bit too used to finding pleasure in materialistic stuff. And this sounds like kind of, you're all gone communist or something like that. No, it's not that. It's just understanding that really how important is the material part of your life. It has a place for sure, but is it the most important aspect of your life? Is that what defines you as a person? Or is it your family? Or is it the quality of time that you have in this life?
Exactly. Exactly. So sometimes, you know, the opportunity in a crisis is we get to re-examine those things and become more conscious of them. So that's, I think, always the silver lining in this story. And yet, excuse me, it's very clear that Argentina is a fuse that's been lit. It's going to burn or smolder for a while. 30% inflation is no fun. 60% is even less fun. Who knows what the number will actually be. But ultimately, there will be some process where this will have to burn itself out, and then the rebuilding can start. That's the thing that worries me about the developed world, is that there has not been a forest fire in our financial ecosystem for many decades now. All of them have been squashed by the well-meaning firefighters in the various central banks. But of course, the tinder is just built, and we always worry that the next forest fire will be just a little bit more destructive than it should have been. So to that point, you know, what I try to advise people to do is to just be aware that these things can happen. They do happen. There are lessons learned, and people can go to your blogspot, furful.blogspot.com, to read more about what's actually happening in Argentina. There's really instructive lessons in there because it's happening. And of course, the culture dictates part of the outcome. I'm sure you would have a very different outcome in Japan because of demographics, because of culture, because of all kinds of reasons. But you know, understanding that how people behave when their money systems fall apart is pretty much universal, at least to some extent. And so I think there's a lot of really important things there for people to read about. And for you, Furful, what are you working on another book, or what are you working on now?
Yes, I'm actually wrapping up a book on bugging out and relocating, which is what I did when I left. I think it's going to be a good book for people. You know, some of them have been asking for something like that. It is quite, as you were talking about before, it's quite enlightening to live everything that you've ever owned. I mean, we left ourselves with just two pieces of luggage each, just two suitcases each. And I remember being in the car and seeing, okay, this is all we have. These are all our material possessions. And at the same time, a few weeks later, when we were settling over here, I was talking about it with my wife, and we said, you know, we don't need anything else. We have everything that we need. And with money, we buy the furniture that we needed or whatever, whatnot, the clothing. Everything else can be replaced. What you cannot replace is yourself, who you are, and your family.
Interesting. So this book about moving to a new location, would that apply, say, equally well? Are there lessons in there that might work within a country? So if I lived in Oakland and didn't like that?
Absolutely, yes. I'm not only discussing some of the countries I was looking at, I'm mostly talking about the mental process and the way of analyzing each choice. That's why it's called bugging out and relocating. You can choose to relocate or not, and you may be lucky enough to never have to do that. Now, bugging out is something that can affect every single person. You just don't know if your house burns down, if there's a natural disaster of some sort, and you just have to grab a small bag and leave and lose everything. Happens all the time to people for various reasons.
Well, it happened to 100,000 people around Fukushima.
Exactly.
And that's a permanent sort of event as far as their lives are concerned. Well, that's very interesting. We'll look forward to that when it comes out. When do you think that's coming out?
Maybe for next month. I'll send you a copy as soon as I have one.
Well, great. Well, we'll get it up on the site and let people know about it, because I'm sure there are people who will be interested in that. We have there's two main topics that people seem very interested in. One is, where should I live, which is germane to your book title there and topic. And the second is the sense of feeling like they're living two lives, like they're stuck in a job, a path, a set of circumstances that is not quite fully their authentic expression. It's not quite what they would be choosing if they had a blank sheet of paper. So they have a sense of wanting to be in some more fulfilling life. So there's that sense of somehow being trapped in the system, whatever that happens to be. So those are the two big things. Where should I live and how should I live, I guess, are those two big parts. And I think those are perfectly reasonable, prudent, normal, healthy things to be asking, particularly when you start seeing the trouble at the edges of the system. It's a very, very good thing to ask early and ask often.
I think it's going to be helping people make those decisions, understanding that sometimes the grass looks greener on the other side of the hill. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you really do have to make a choice, and it's not nice to regret not making a move if you chose to do so. But also, there's going to be a lot of people that, after reading this book, are going to be appreciating where they live and what they have.
How about you? Do you regret moving?
No, not one bit. Not at all. I couldn't have been happier, especially seeing all this going on. It's the best thing we could have done, no doubt about it.
Well, congratulations on the foresight, and I hope that your book has similar insights that can help people make their own decisions. And Ferfel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Chris. It was, as always, great talking with you, and we have to do it again.
Absolutely.